Insperity presents the Small Business Advocate Show with Jim Blasingame. This is a copyrighted production of Small Business Network, Inc. All rights reserved.
Now back to ringside with the voice of small business and the champion of the entrepreneur.
Say it now, gentlemen. Undisputed heavyweight champion of the world.
The Small Business Advocate, Jim Blasingame.
We're back. It's 34 after. Thank you for joining us very much. 800-531-3815, and my website is www.jbsba.com. Don't forget to subscribe to my free newsletter when you get there. Rich Galen is our guest. Rich Galen, ladies and gentlemen, is a political operative of the Republican persuasion. He's the guy who makes Democrats understand why they are they're Democrats. He's our good friend. Rich, welcome back.
Thank you, my friend. How are you?
Good. It's good to have you back. And by the way, folks, Rich is the author and the publisher of an outstanding tri-weekly document called Mullings, and it's mullings.com is the location where you can subscribe.
Is it tri-weekly or thrice-weekly?
Thrice-weekly. Okay, whatever. One of the, you know, try to give you a plug here. Hey, Rich.
Shut up and be gracious for once in your life.
That's exactly right. Happy Father's Day.
Thank you, my friend. Same to you, and happy Grandfather's Day.
Yeah, how about that? That's pretty cool, news. Isn't it?
Great news.
Yeah, thanks. Let's talk about fathers a little bit. I was telling Bill Hubbard and I, all four of the people on my show today are men, and they're all fathers. Some of them are grandfathers, and at least two of them that I know, me and Bill Hubbard, are grandfathers. You've still got that precious moment to come.
Well, as far as I know, I'm not.
As far as you know, yeah.
I've spent a lot on it, but I don't know.
Rich, the thing that you and I are you're a lot younger than me, but you and I are pretty much in the same generation. And one of the things that Bill Hubbard pointed out, and we were talking about last half hour, was how much the generation that raised us, the men who raised us, weren't all that demonstrative, and that you learned more. What I said was I learned more by osmosis from my dad than I learned out of his mouth.
Well, you know, that's a good point. We're not that far apart in age. My dad was a World War II vet, so.
Mine too.
So I think that had a lot to do with the way that they emoted. I mean, one of the things, we've all watched a thousand war movies and read the books and what have you. And one of the things that comes through in all of them was the notion of you didn't want to make very close friends in World War II because you didn't want to lose a close friend. Mm-hmm. So if you didn't have him, if somebody got killed, then he wasn't a close friend and he could go on. I think, for the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of men that went through that process, I think that had a huge impact, not just on them, but on the culture that they brought back with them, that the notion of being emotive, in the late 40s, the 50s, and all the way into the 60s was really not, it just wasn't part of the American culture. I mean, think back to even like Robert Young and Father Knows Best. He would put his arm around one of the girls, but I don't remember him ever hugging whatever the boy's name was.
Right.
So, I mean, it was just,
Bud.
You're right. I think that's
his name was Bud.
Bud, right, Bud. That he couldn't, it just wasn't done back in those days. Now, Reed and I hug, my son and I, we hug every time we...
Exactly. Me too. Well, here's the thing, Rich. Don't forget, too, before they went to war, they came through the austerity of a depression.
Also true.
Think about how tough...
There's only so much emotion that you have, and if a good deal of it is put over to trying to make sure nobody in your family is starving or they're not sleeping in the streets, then you just don't have a lot left over, I think, maybe.
Well, but what I remember, my dad's still alive. He's 80 years old, but I just remember observing my dad and watching him do the right thing. I never caught him doing something that wouldn't have made me proud.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
I wrote about that a little bit this morning. I wrote about Gregory Peck and David Brinkley and a guy named Adam Clymer, who's a writer for the New York Times, who didn't die. He just retired. But the thing about the Gregory Peck thing that I remembered, that kind of symbolized him for me. Frankly, I was shocked to find out he was 87. I had no idea.
I know it. Yeah.
But there was a scene in To Kill a Mockingbird where he had his client, Tom Robinson, who was a black guy wrongly accused of rape, had been convicted by a white jury. And in the courtroom scene in the movie, all the blacks had to sit up in the balcony and all the whites were downstairs. And Gregory, Atticus Finch, who Gregory Peck was playing, his daughter was sitting up in the balcony with the black spectators. And as he was walking out of the courtroom after this trial, all of the spectators upstairs stood up, silently just stood up. And his daughter, whose name was Scout, was just sitting there kind of leaning over the rail, and the man next to her said, "You got to stand up, darling, because," and she said, "Why?" He said, "Because your daddy is passing by."
Yeah, that was one of the most, that was one of the strongest moments in cinema that I've ever seen. I agree with you.
And Gregory Peck pulled it
absolutely
up.
You know, I saw him a few years ago being interviewed. He was like probably 82 or 83. Uh-huh. I hope I look that good when I'm 57.
Yeah.
Stand by, 22. We'll be right back with Rich Galen. Stay with us, folks. We're back at 17 till. I'm Jim Blasingame, the Small Business Advocate. And my guests in the next hour are an old friend and a new friend. The new friend is David Wagner. And David, this is Rich, this is a guy that you might want to know about because he's a world-renowned hairdresser. Hello? Hello?
Certainly want to know. If I had any hair, I'd certainly want to.
You want me to hook you up with him? I think he might be able to.
Yeah, well, I always felt, you know, former Senator Alan Simpson of Wyoming used to say, "God only gave us so many hormones. If you want to waste yours on hair, that's up to you."
what a world-class wit he is. Now, he's the guy that I'd like to hang out with.
Yeah, you bet. Oh, no,
Alan Simpson
nice
of Wyoming. Let's get back in. I want to talk just a little bit more about fathers, and I want to move into to some of these other guys that you were talking about in your piece. The thing that I remember about my father, one of the things I remember growing up was he and my mother. There was a period of time when they didn't get along,
uh-huh.
And he actually left one day. I remember him storming out and leaving, and I asked my older sister. I said, "Where did Dad go?" I was probably 8 or 9. I said, "Where'd Dad go?" She said, "He's left." She's 6 years older than me.
Uh-huh.
And I said, "What do you mean he's left?" And she said, "He's gone." I said, "Well, is he coming back?" She said, "I don't think so."
Ooh.
And so, you know, I mean, I don't remember being all busted up about it, but I just, you know, I was just a kid. And so I went through my day. Well, about 4 or 5 hours later, he comes back. And I'll never forget what he said. I said, "Dad, why did you come back?" You know, out of the mouths of babes, right? I said, "Dad, why did you come back?" He said, "I couldn't stand the thought of not being with you children."
Ugh.
Now, he stayed there and worked it out with my mother, but you know what? That never left me.
Yeah.
And so later on, as all couples do, you know, you go through those tough times.
Right.
You know, I said, "You know what? I'm going to raise my children." And so, I mean, like I said before, I didn't get a lot of philosophy, but I sure got a lot of good examples.
You know, I guess there's a business piece of this too. I mean, that happens especially in small businesses more than big businesses. Big businesses, you know, we've talked about this before. You mm-hmm. can lose, you know, you can lose $100 million and it's somebody else's money, so you just take your bonus and
right.
go home. If it's a small business, if you lose,
you catch your
shoe.
Yeah, you
lose $20, you can't meet payroll, and it ain't
right.
money. But you hang in there because you believe in something bigger than yourself, whether it's your business or your family or your country or whatever it is. I mean, I think it's all of a piece. I did a speech last night to the Financial Services Roundtable folks, the big banks, you know, big, huge Citibank and those guys. And this was the group of their vice presidents for public affairs. And the point I made to them at the end of my remarks was that, you know, one of the great, and you've traveled a lot too, so you know this, one of the main underpinnings of the American system of freedom is the freedom to succeed and the freedom to fail. And the reason that we're successful is that because we're such damned optimists
mm-hmm.
all the time. We really
yeah.
think we can succeed.
We do.
And that's what makes banks in America go, because everybody sitting behind every desk in every one of the branches in every state in which you guys operate is somebody sitting there that is optimistic.
Yeah.
Asking for a loan, and the loan officer is optimistic, and you're helping make stuff better. And that's part of what you're talking about with your dad. He was optimistic that he believed in something bigger than himself. Mm-hmm.
That's exactly right. He was willing to stick to it, and there's no question that I got stick-to-itiveness from him. And something you just mentioned though about Americans, the opposite of that, because these people won't accept the concept of failure, are the Japanese. I'm not trying to diss a whole nation here, folks, with one speech, but the Japanese won't recognize that they've got some failures and take their lumps and write it off, and consequently, yes, their economy is in a perennial recession.
That's right, for a 15-year recession.
Exactly.
That's right.
I mean, what you just said is exactly right, and it's what you're right. I mean, we're very one of the ways we're successful is because we have learned how to fail, haven't we?
Yeah, and years ago I heard an essay on NPR where a guy had moved from Pittsburgh to like Dallas, and we may have talked about this. And he said the essence of it was that he had gone broke in Pittsburgh, and his kids were ostracized, and they couldn't go to the same church. I mean, it's just horrible. And he said he got to Texas, and he found out that the worst sin in Texas is not going broke. The worst sin is not picking yourself up and starting again.
Yeah, he said, not trying.
He said, and this is true. I've heard people say this in Texas because we lived there for most of the 90s. The phrase is, everybody gets into a bad cow deal once in their life.
Yeah.
And you know what? You just sell off the herd, pay the bill, and get on and start again. and that's I really think that's. That's kind of that swagger that Texans have.
It is.
They're just optimistic that sooner or later they're going to get it fixed and get back on their feet.
Changing the subject a little bit, Rich, you wrote about David Brinkley, and I wanted to talk a little bit about David Brinkley, too, today. And David Brinkley, I learned about politics as a very small child by watching David Brinkley and Chet Huntley do the 1960 presidential primaries.
The convention, right?
I learned about politics as a 10, 11 year old in those days.
You are old. Holy
I am. God. I'm really old. But I learned some other things from David. I'm gonna let you. We'll come back after the break. I'm gonna let you tell your story about David, because folks, this is an example about you may never want to meet your heroes. But one thing I learned about David Brinkley which will surprise you, which I'll tell you about in a minute. I learned from David Brinkley about 15 years ago, maybe a little bit more, something that probably will surprise you. And I'll tell you what that is when we come back after these messages. Tintail, stay with us. We'll be right back with Rich Galen, Mullings.com. Check that website out, folks. We're back. It's 7 till. I'm Jim Blassingame, the Small Business Advocate. Rich Galen is our guest and our good friend. Folks, you need to check out his thrice-weekly article, which comes out by email three times a week, as I say, and you'll like it. It is of the Republican persuasion. It is bent to the right, no question about it. But I'm sure there are plenty of left-leaning folks who subscribe, and he's got something under a million subscribers now, folks, and so check it out when you get a chance at Mullings.com. I recommend it to you. I don't miss his article, and I appreciate the work that you do, Rich.
Thank you, friend.
Rich,
I tell you what, I have to get it written on Sundays before I read yours, or else you'll influence me. So I don't try not to read you before I write.
Rich, when about 18 years ago, I guess, maybe 16, 17, 18 years ago, David Brinkley wrote a book called Washington Goes to War.
Right.
And, as you know, people who don't write may not think about this, but if you write very much, you realize that there's two of the styles of writing is first person and third person.
Right.
And first person has a lot of personal pronoun references to yourself, and the other has third person pronouns primarily. And so David Brinkley wrote his book, which is a report about what happened to Washington during the war, and it was his personal experience.
Right.
But the entire book was written in third person. And what that taught me, without realizing, I didn't realize it until I was well into the book, because I was trying to start my writing career in those days. And I noticed what he was doing, and I said, I need to do, this is, this is a good example of how to write third person, or how to write to make it more interesting, which means less of me.
Uh-huh.
Now, I still write the first person a fair amount, and there are pieces that I write where maybe I only make one single personal pronoun or personal reference, mm-hmm. with an I or a me or something like that. Maybe there's only one in the whole piece, and it's got to. But what I'm getting at is what I learned is I only put me into it. I only use I, me in my pieces when it's absolutely necessary. It's got to be judicious.
Yeah.
And that was a good lesson for him to teach me without even realizing it.
Yeah. No. Well, I mean, there's no question. I think in the history of television reporters, that David Brinkley is known as one of the best writers in the history of television.
Yes, he is.
And when you travel around with these reporters now, television reporters, writing is not, it's not only not a strength, it's not even something the producers are looking for. They're looking for, you know, cute and witty.
They're looking for the face. Look at you.
Well, that's right. Look at me. That's why I get so much TV time, so that they can compare their people with me. But that is true. I mean, now if you look at what TV reporters are doing, especially on the cable nets, they're all stand-up sort of chatty things, so they don't write, literally. They don't write anything because they're just standing there and talking.
Well, somebody else writes their stuff.
Or somebody else writes it. In the studios, of course, they're just reading it off a teleprompter, so the notion of sitting down and actually writing a piece doesn't exist. I was doing MSNBC one day from Secaucus, which is the mothership.
New Jersey,
It's a fabulous studio when you go there.
Mm-hmm.
And Dan Abrams, who's MSNBC's chief legal guy,
mm-hmm.
had a, it's called a package, a package piece that was on just before I was going on.
Yeah.
And it was so well written that after I got off the air, after my little 5 or 6 minute thing, I walked over to his desk and I said, "That was some of the best writing I have heard on television in years." And he was so thrilled that somebody had recognized that he had obviously worked very hard
on
getting the
work. He didn't just deliver it well. He was well written.
Well written, exactly.
Yeah. Well, I've only got about a minute, and I know that you had an experience with David Brinkley many years ago that wasn't all that good, and I wish we had time for you to tell it, because it's an interesting story. But the thing we ought to remember, Rich, is that David Brinkley introduced me to politics and to world affairs all during my life and imprinted that on me and made me a news junkie.
Well, you know, he and Chet Huntley were news for a lot of people. There wasn't anybody in second place. They were it.
But I don't know that young kids are getting that getting that influence right now.
Part of it is because of so many other distractions.
We didn't have anything else. We didn't have anything else to do, did we?
Yeah, you might have only gotten two channels on your TV. Period.
I was my dad's remote control too.
That's right. You didn't get three choices of which Nickelodeon network you wanted to watch.
Correct. Hey, Rich, thank you for being here today.
Happy Father's Day, my friend, and congratulations on the grandson.
You too, sir. Thank you very much. Rich Galen, ladies and gentlemen, Mullings.com. Check that out. Got to go for this hour. Before I do, I want to thank my heroes, small business owners, because without your courage, hard work, and devotion to your dreams, America would not be the greatest entrepreneurial country in the world. This is Jim Blasingame, the Small Business Advocate, and this program is for you. Happy Father's Day.
Insperity presents the Small Business Advocate Show with Jim Blasingame. This is a copyrighted production of Small Business Network, Inc., intended for the private use of our audience. Except as otherwise provided by copyright law, all other copying, redistribution, or publication without prior written consent is prohibited. All rights reserved.